This is the regular monthly meeting of Downers Grove Grade School District 58, Board of Education, Monday, November 14th, 2016, at 7 p.m. at the Longfellow Center. Pam, would you please call roll?
Member Deal?
Here.
Member Hefner?
Here.
Member Pescu?
Here.
Member Miller?
Here.
Member Purcell?
Here.
Member Siegel?
Here.
Member Cooper?
Here. First up is a flag salute. Todd McDaniel? Oh, there you are. I'll hand it to you. I think we want to do the flag salute first.
Oh, he knows what to do.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Breakfast foods and fundraisers for our After school
Typically, we see dedicated to learn how to stay drunk and lazy, while also attending a week full of spirit days and holidays. And finally, our art day. We do the whole spring brings in bottle caps and makes pennies. We take the bottle caps and make them part of a big barrel, as you can see on here. And the pendants are sold for a daily profit. People bid on these medals, and it really is a good one. Most importantly, everyone in public feels important, and they were a little small fortune for a great profit. Now, Matthew, our Vice President of
Public. Hi, my name is Matthew Shirota, our school's Vice President, and I'll be talking to you about what we're doing at Public School right now. At the beginning of October, we made our very first all-school picture fundraiser. Each grade wore a different color, and at the end of the day, we went outside so a drone could take a picture of our school. We sold pictures at a very minimal cost. Also, we are doing stencil sales to help fundraise for gift cards that we collect in the Thanksgiving basket. Stencils are centered pencils that our students really like. The Thanksgiving baskets are filled by our students and staff and given to families in need from our own school. A little while back, we had a custom stock spirit wear day as part of Red Ribbon Week with the slogan, "Stay in the game, don't do drugs." On Election Day, we sponsored a wear red, white, or blue spirit day. Thank you for listening to what we've been doing so far this year. Now let's direct your attention back to
So, go on Twitter to follow us or watch soon.
You guys want to come up? We have gifts for coming in. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Great job. Thanks
great
for telling us all you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Good job.
Thank you. Great job.
Good job, man. Good job.
Oh, thank you.
Good job.
Good job, guys.
Good job.
Thank you, Student Council. Well done. Mrs. Herter is here from our PTA. She's one of our co-presidents, and she's going to give a little highlight about some of the great things that our PTA does to proactively support us at Henry Puffer.
So, hi, everybody. I'm Kristen Herter, one of the co-presidents of the Puffer PTA. So we're having a great year cover this year. Our membership numbers have never looked better. We're at 200-plus PTA members for the year. Through our many fundraisers, we were able to raise over $30,000 last year. And our biggest single fundraiser by far is our trivia night that we held in March and raised over $18,000 this year. Our PTA supports not only the 300-plus cover students, but also the 100-plus students that attend the Grove Preschool at cover. Our preschool families are invited to all of our PTA events, and we fund the Halloween and winter fashion parties for all the classrooms, including the 8th preschool class. So through our successful fundraising, we've been able to fund, among other things, the following. We bring a DuPage Children's Museum and e-learning labs at our school. We've purchased coding robots from Ollie. We've given a $100 gift card to every classroom teacher to use as they see fit for the class. That includes the preschool teachers. We've purchased level readers for the kindergarten classrooms. Research database, which is it's for the library and supports students at all reading levels. And we also purchased a kit that allows us to do a family bath night at Puffer, which is a great program. One other concept we picked up last year, which has had great feedback, was a grade level ambassador idea, where basically the 1 to 2 parents per grade level that basically are there to get information out to the families at grade level. We welcome new families as they trickle in throughout the year, and it's really a nice point person for the grade. They organize several get-togethers, whether it be play dates just for the kids or an adult night out. So basically, it helps us, the families be able to feel more connected to Puffer. And throughout the year, we organize several special events, such as a back-to-school ice cream social, long run that promotes food and fitness, you know, pumpkin carving night, daddy-daughter dance, mother-son gym jam, VIP day, which is next week, which the kids love. It's basically every single student is allowed to bring in a very important person on the same day, and they do a special hour-long project in the classroom. We do a family holiday breakfast, talent show, field day, walking club at our recess during fall and spring, and last we do a 6th grade breakfast at the end of the year, which really is kind of final great year, and we thank you guys.
Thank you. Next up is public comment on the 2016 tax levy. David, would you like to start us off?
Sure. Thank you. Last month, I presented to you a proposed tentative levy for the 2016 levy year. That totaled in the capped funds $53.4 million, with approximately another $1.5 million in debt service extension. This is a little bit over 2.2% increase year over year. The levy is the way that the district raises the bulk of the funds that are used to operate the district to pay staff salaries, provide for facilities, and other costs of operating the district. The ability to raise revenue is capped under the law, under the tax cap law, to increase the levy by no more than 5% or the consumer price index. For this current year, the applicable consumer price index inflator is 0.7%. So what that means is that we're able to increase our property taxes by no more than 0.7%, but we also do get the benefit of any new construction which happens across the district. We're looking at probably about $19 million in new construction. That might be that's a projection for this next year. The actual will probably be fairly close to that, although the levy does provide for a little bit more than that in case there's an unexpected pop in terms of new construction numbers. So just a couple final points to summarize. The district will only receive a 0.7% increase in levied tax dollars plus any increase that's attributable to new construction. And the new construction number will be about up to $36 million, although we expect it to really be closer to $20 million. The bond and interest levy is set at the time that the bonds were issued, so there's nothing new relative to that. The process where we are right now is in between the tentative and the final levy. The final levy has to be filed with the county clerk by the last Tuesday in December. And you'll, in addition to public comment tonight, you'll have an opportunity to consider then the final recommendation on the final levy at your next meeting.
Thank you. Next is the board agenda. The board will hear public comment on the proposed 2016 tax levies. At this time, anyone wishing to be heard, please stand, state your name, attendance area, and organization, if any, for the record. Sorry, we have to give it a certain amount of time. All right, last call. Tonight we're going to have two receptions of visitors later in the agenda to give members of the audience an opportunity to speak. Cards have been provided in the back of the room on the back table for convenience of audience members wishing to speak during the reception of visitors. The board asks anyone wishing to comment to sign in and indicate on the card the topic to be addressed. These can be placed in the basket on the table on Megan's table. They will be used for reference during the reception of visitors. Just want to make sure everybody gets a chance to be heard. Next up are the non-action reports. Would be the spotlight on schools, the math curriculum update. Dr. Mac Rich.
We're really excited to be here today. Curriculum workshop after we've completed some training professional development, we can even give a math curriculum update today. And we have a lot of members from our math committee and our math planning committee, which is a subset of that committee here. They'll be sharing our information. I'm going to try to recognize every math committee member that's in the room. I'm not sure I can see everyone in here, so if I miss you, I apologize. Those will be presenting tonight from our planning committee. Linda Vanacora, Tracy DeBure, Tracy Moriarty, Katie Perkins, Kelly Vicinius, I know back there, and Matt Neustadt. I think also here tonight, and I'm trying to see if I can remember, Juliani Quinto, Andy Schmidt. I think Jason Lind is back there. I think I see a head back there, but I'm not sure. Looking down, I saw Pat Cesarek, Kathy Yee, and Carrie Murphy, Karen Novak, and Chris Wallace. Did I miss anybody? We're a large committee. We're doing a lot of great work. And we're excited to share it with you today. And we're also glad for everybody to find a way to be here tonight to share it, to be part of our, the sharing of our work. So I'm going to turn it over. And we're going to talk a little bit about COVID.
Hi, I'm Tracy Moriarty. I'm a resource teacher over in Pierce Downer. I'm happy to be back here to talk to you tonight about all the work that has been done on the blueprint. It continues to be a work in progress, but teachers are using it, and adjustments are being made to continue to improve it as we go through it and learn through the use of it. Blueprint cards now exist for all grade levels, pre-K through Common Core 8. And teachers are using the blueprint to guide the instruction, following the topics and also the resources that have been put in place. We've had the opportunity to get a lot of feedback from the teachers on the blueprint, and it has been positive. We're going to continue to solicit feedback from all of the teachers as we get deeper into the year to make sure that what we put in place is meeting the needs of both students and the teachers. One thing that has been really positive for all of us that have been in the math committee is that other committees are looking to follow our template, which makes us feel very good about all the work we've been doing. Some areas that we still need significant work on is the area of assessment and on the high cognitive demand task, which we'll talk about more in a moment. But we wanted to give you just a snapshot of how the blueprint has progressed and changed a little bit. So on the next two slides, you're going to see a snapshot of the blueprint. This comes from 7th grade, 3rd quarter. As you can see, since we last showed, the progression of skills has been added, which is that blue banner that goes across the top. We have this on every card, and it shows the skills as they have progressed in all the grades previous. On the next slide, you also see our deconstructed standards, as well as additional resources that have been put in for each of the topics. And this allows us as teachers to see specifically what we're targeting and working on. The next area that we'll be working on are the assessments and the high cognitive demands, and those will be filled on the blueprint as well. But all of that is going to be developed through the professional development that we're getting this year. So Katie Herkins and Tracy DeBeer are going to tell us a little bit more about
Hi, I'm Katie Herkins. I teach first grade at Puffer. And I'm going to talk to you about the first half of the professional development that we, that all of our teachers that teach math have been going through. So we had the first of four sessions with the Metro Chicago Mathematics Initiative to provide professional development for all of our teachers in our district. So all teachers that teach math were given in October one full day with their grade level. The first half of the day was with the Mathematics Initiative, and the second half was at their grade level. We have received some pretty really positive feedback from those days from our teachers, that they appreciated having an outside group come in to give a consistent training across our board from our kindergarten through eighth grade teachers. A lot of the focus was on what you've now heard of high cognitive demand experiences, which is a mouthful to say. We were previously referring to these as our just deeper, things that were going deeper, encouraging our students to have more beyond that paper and pencil experience where they were just solving a problem. So we're going to use the phrase high cognitive demand experiences with our students. And we have a couple of examples on the next two slides to share with you. So one example that can be a simple task that we can take deeper with our students is the simple question of which one doesn't belong. And the answer, as you can look at, is any of them. So whether you said the triangle or the square on its side or the rhombus or diamond, any of those are correct. The much more important part is why. And so we can have a student answer any of those, but we're looking for the why did you choose that one. And that can allow a teacher very quickly to see what skills a student might have, where we can go deeper, how we can compare what student A did to student B, and how they can maybe have a conversation about that topic. So that's one example. The other example would be a much higher grade level, I would say. The other one can be used at any grade level. This one isn't going to be used with our lower primary students, but the example is that each fruit represents a single digit 0 through 9. Each fruit represents the same number in every equation. Two pieces of fruit next to each other without an operation is a two-digit number. So this is much more than just a simple computation problem. It's asking students to dig deep, to probably try multiple options and multiple strategies before coming to an answer. And so these are the types of problems that we're looking to add into the blueprint to build on some of those experiences for our learners that might be looking for or were looking to take them deeper into that topic instead of just pushing them ahead to the next topic. I'm going to let Tracy talk about our other component of professional development.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the assessment development, we're working with the DuPage ROE to provide professional development for MathCity members in appropriate high quality assessments in mathematics. There's a total of 2 full-day sessions, one November, one that's December. We're focusing on the validity and the reliability. We're also working to ensure topic and assessment match. Our first session was on November 2nd, so that's complete. Our next one is coming up on December 2nd, so not too far off. And the assessment development planning and implementation will occur after we've completed all of our training. And I'm going to turn it over to Linda Manicora, and she is going to talk about acceleration.
I'm Linda Manicora, I teach fifth grade every year. So we define consistent approaches for identifying students. We use the MAP data consistently towards about the 85th percentile. We've reviewed at least 3 data points. We have the 80th to 85th percentile have additional data as deemed necessary, math placement tests, to be decided at a later date, 2017-18 and beyond. We talked about teacher recommendations, including those best math practices. We talked about principal approval, and then parent notification. And all schools will be implementing this by the second semester of this year. I will turn it over to Kelly Lucinio.
Thank you, I'm Kelly Lucinio. I teach 7th grade for Matthew O'Neill. Our acceleration at the middle school, again, kind of looks a little bit different with our accelerated math students that will enter accelerated math in 7th grade. Those students will receive a Common Core 8 content, as well as a heavy focus with those mathematical practices, and we know that's going to, of course, involve those high cognitive demand type problems. Accelerated math for 8th graders will include the Math 1 curriculum, which is what is taught currently at the high school, again, with that heavy focus on the mathematical practices, those high cognitive demand questions. Math A and B opportunities will still remain for those students who are not identified in that early process like Linda was speaking about. So again, those students still have that opportunity to jump to that math A and B process, even if they weren't identified earlier in the elementary sort of track. Less time will be available for specific work in math practices because we do have to combine sort of 2 years or 3 years of math in 2 years. We will, of course, try to include as many of those high demand activities as we can, but again, with combining both or all of those levels together, always our challenge at the middle school is making sure we have enough time for curriculum and then for some of those extension activities as well. Okay. Matt Musitz will talk about our flow chart.
So I'm Matt Musitz, I'm the principal here. We have had something similar to this previously created. With our new accelerated math classes, we wanted to take another look and add those classes in. So you can see that bottom half is really our new accelerated math program. And it goes through what Kelly really just described with students in 6th grade in the accelerated math completing Common Core 7, 7th grade Common Core 8, and then the 8th graders completing Math 1. What you can see about our flowchart is there are still options for students to move from track to track, so it is not a, once you're there, you're stuck kind of thing. There is opportunity for movement from one track to the other through 7th and 8th grade, and then also the transition from 8th to 9th grade going into District 99.
I think one of the most important things from an outside perspective is we have kids that are every year moving up that ladder. It's not just that it's available there, but it's occurring.
Yeah, and it's throughout the school year. It's not just during first quarter, we had some that, when the teachers come to me and say, student X does no longer needs the support of double block math, we move them into the regular Common Core track to free up that second period and give them that core very fast.
I think one of the neat things that's happened is that some of the children that were in Common Core 7, it's in first quarter, we had several where we've seen some great performance as a early seventh grader. The suggestion has been to move them to Math A. You've been contacting, local schools have been contacting their sixth grade teachers. And so the sixth grade teachers are still kind of part of the process as we get to know them at the middle school, and they've been making the jump. That, I think, is some of our data that we have. I'd love to open up some board for questions for myself or the committee.
Can I just say something? I'm totally in awe of this. I can't believe all the work that you people have put into this. It's amazing. I know a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and maybe a few bottles of wine went into this. But it's amazing. I mean, to try and meet the needs of every child in your classroom is overwhelming. And to have this blueprint for a teacher is just so awesome. I know when I taught, to try and meet every child's needs seemed unbelievable. I couldn't do it. But you're finding a way to do it. And I think what it comes down to is that in District 58, we're meeting the needs of every child in our classrooms, and that is awesome. Thank you so much for your hard work. Really, I know the board agrees with me. It's been a long road, I know, and it's not been easy, and it's not going to be easy. But when we look at the whole picture and what we're doing this for, it's for the kids, and it's going to be great for them. So thank you so much.
And thank you for clarifying the movement, too. I think a lot of people I've heard think you get stuck in one and, oh, I'm stuck in that forever. And I mean, not only this one shows you moving from grade to grade, but there also probably is an arrow that goes, you can move from double period to Common Core, you just said, in the same year. And I've seen that happen. I got firsthand experience on that. And it's great. It's nice seeing the progression to meeting the individual needs of the kids. And it's tough because every group's different, right? You know, it's this constant moving train, and the train can't stop, and you got to make adjustments while it's going. And I know that takes a lot of work, and I know it's frustrating for people and parents and kids and the teachers and administrators. But you know, we're making progress, we're going through it, and we're doing what is best for those children, and we're able to individualize a little bit. I think that's one of the biggest problems I think a lot of people have with education, is we've traditionally tried to teach to that mean, and there's people on either side of that mean that either need to be accelerated or need to kind of be pulled up, and to kind of see this roadmap or flowchart kind of puts it in a visual perspective of how we can do that.
I was just going to ask, I know when you all presented whatever really hot day it was over the summer, and one of the things we talked about was the need perhaps for more professional development, and it sounds like you've gotten a lot of that. Do you feel like, from a board perspective, you're getting everything that you need to move this forward?
I think at this point, yes. We got what we asked for in terms of asking for someone from outside to come in and provide us with the same training. We have been able to provide them with some feedback. The only real consistent piece we received was that we had asked that they be a little bit more specific in the grade level that they were presenting to. And as far as what Matt has let us know, they've been receptive to that. They've communicated with us after the training with the resources that they provided. I think asking us again after maybe the third session, do we feel that is the fourth going to be enough, or do we feel that we need to continue on because there's other topics? I'm sure we would appreciate that question coming back to us later in the spring. But I think at this point, as far as the feedback we've heard, and we've been pretty diligent about, like, after each one, reaching out to the teachers at that grade level, that they've been pleased with what we have at this point.
I think the one unknown that we have right now is we started on the track for math professional development for the classroom teacher. We started the assessment training for the committee. And I think we're going to be figuring out what this assessment challenge is and what the scope of that is, and that's going to take us some time. We may be coming back and saying, this is really what needs to be involved to make this happen. And we just don't know the answers to that because we're learning what the questions are.
Thank you.
I think also the last board meeting we talked about that the alternative resources and that was being built out.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that will continue to just evolve every year if somebody finds something or would like something different? Do you see? Do you envision that, you know, things being taken off, other things added, or at some point it's going to grow too much?
I mean, I think it's going to take us 3 years to get a stable blueprint.
Okay.
Because we went through these 8-9 days of teacher training. And I had probably 65 emails of people, this fits in here, this adjustment needs to be here, this happened here. I think I finally finished third grades today, and all grades have gotten those adjustments in. But it was really great to see the dynamic nature of it. And that, as we get more comfortable and we've done it twice through, we're going to feel pretty stable with it. But right now, people are finding out what are those favorite activities, really what could match, and finding some things that just don't work. There was one where I did, was kindergarten, and we said, this unit is not working. The resources in math and focus just don't match out to what we need. And so as a team, we're going to go back to the drawing board a little bit and say, okay, what could go there? And we might look beyond our team. In this particular one, we might be accessing some of the speech pathologists because they might have materials that fit with that particular topic more than we do. And so it's going to be finding that out for the next 2 years. And we've done some creative things on the menuing that compress the resources so they're not overwhelming to the teacher unless you really want them. Just to give you an example of that, if you look up on, not an example here. Maybe I'm still walking. Oops. No, I'm not logged in. We have a drop-in menu that pulls in and pulls out that will expand to what resources we do for like Khan Academy, IXL, and so if we see something getting too big, it expands up or down for the teachers.
I'd just like to thank everybody for your hard work and dedication. It really shows. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to also thank everybody. And I guess what I want to make sure is what we here as a board is, when we look at the blueprint, there was a lot of work that, that went into it. And then when it comes to the, to the day-to-day teaching and learning in the classrooms, that this blueprint is, as it's being rolled out, that it actually really gives the teachers, okay, this is how I can make sure that I have my lesson plans that I need to do to teach the children in my class, that I have the resources available to me so I can, print out the worksheets or whatever it is that are there for the daily lesson plans, et cetera. And that's the kind of feedback that, I hope to hear, that not only, we put together these great blueprints, but then when it really comes down to the implementation of these blueprints, that it's making that teaching and learning experience really a more efficient process. So, obviously everybody's put a lot of work into it, and that's, looking for that success at that level. So I don't know if there's any examples of how it's actually helping people in the classroom, students and teachers yet, if it's actually being used at that level yet, but if there are, that'd be great to hear. And if we kind of took a look at that, I guess, the flow chart, I know there was definitely a lot of concern and confusion about the kids coming into seventh grade this year and where they were going and how they can, progress. And I think, math has always been that way. I've had, my first kid to go through math is now a junior in college, and I now have one in seventh grade, so I've seen kind of different evolutions. But hopefully this provides clarity, at least, to the parents as to where their children are going, and to the teachers as to knowing what kind of kids they're going to be teaching in the class. So, it does seem pretty clear. I think probably as we were talking about this chart, one question we did have, it's not the district related, but it's more of like when we get to high school is, there's like a Calc 3 that some people can take in senior year. We weren't sure if this path actually allowed people to get there. But it might be that maybe high school has to rethink their pre-calculus class or something like that because of math one, math two, math three, maybe that. But that was kind of a question we did have on that, but it's beyond the grade school. But yeah,
I think we can answer hopefully, and I'm gonna look at a teacher's day and talk about maybe what it feels like for implementation. I know some of our teachers maybe probably can answer that particular side. Mm-hmm. We're very privileged in this district to have a tight relationship with District 99. And to have my counterpart, Gina Sicardi, often at our MAP meetings, along with both department chair, Jacob Giblin, and John Heldman, and before that we have Paul Stevenson being actively part of our team. This path of our acceleration gives children an opportunity to get to the calculus. It does not aim for the semester of current calculus three. Now, down with 99, we had some deep conversations with 99 and specifically with our middle school team about what do we need to prepare mathematicians for, what are they looking for, and what really makes a difference for kids. Because we did look at exit models that had a three-year acceleration within two for the kids that are in accelerated math, and the recommendation was they really need these math practices, they really need a heavy dose of math habits in mind, that they have very few kids that do Calc 3, and we still have some of those outliers in our district that are accelerated beyond the acceleration, that are 3, 4, 5 students that are outside of the blueprint, that are truly at that point and need that piece. And what 99 says, that is truly an exception for them for the number of kids there that are looking at that. And that should stay the exception for it. But really to be successful and really form at these high levels of mathematics and be able to apply that in their AP physics, AP chemistry type classes, that the effort and energy put into math practices and those habits of mind, as they would call them in 99, is where the investment needs to be. And so Andy and Kelly and the middle school teams and Matt, and we all sat down and said, what is the thing that makes sense? And we made a very conscious choice to say, we're going to put this into the math problem solving, those practices, and we're going to spend more quality time there. We're going to give chances to kids that didn't have the chance to accelerate yet, but we know that's at the sacrifice of someone of this greater need, but we want to open up more of those kids to calculus, but we made a conscious choice not to force that pace even faster with the next piece, but really put the investment where 99 thought the money would be and where we thought it would be. I don't know, Kelly and Matt and Andy, if you have anything else to add to that process.
And then this is really petty, but if you go to the fruit example,
yes,
there is no 7. I'm just letting you know. but other than that, you know,
part of the challenge. We had a number is represented.
But there's no fruit for 7.
Don't spoil any more of it.
Get a pint.
Oh, no, I don't think that'll spoil any.
I'm doing it tonight.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next up is the Henry Puffer Playground Committee update.
Todd, I know you have a team of people here representing your PTA and your playground committee. Would you care to introduce them for us?
We do. This comes from a simple question that was asked at the PTA meeting about 4 years ago about adding a couple of swings on one of the playgrounds. And the discussions led to the realization that saving a couple thousand dollars a year, it would take about 30, 40 years to get to the point where we could add some playground equipment, and needs have grown, and Mrs. Herkes has kind of organized a small group. We have several parents here that are working with Mrs. Herkes, and have put together a plan and a mission to move that 34 years down to a very small number of years. So if you're on the playground committee, can you just raise your hand so we can see who you are? So thank you for your time. Your commitment, Mrs. Herkes, is probably starting soon.
I'm trying. Here we go, Mr. Ramke is going to share speak with you this evening. I'm just trying to get the technology.
There we go.
Well, thanks everybody for your time. My name is Nick Ramke. I have three children at Pucker School. I'm here on behalf of the Playground Committee. As Mr. McDaniel mentioned, you're looking to raise a significant amount of funds to replace the playground equipment in Pucker and a large playground. So we've got some concept drawings done. As you can see, we're looking at a complete and total replace. That is due to our playground equipment being quite old, much like myself, it's starting to show its age after a number of years. So we are concerned about the structural integrity. We're concerned about the ability of the playground equipment to service all the kids at our school as well as in our community, very specifically some of the special needs children that we have at our school. Again, we are looking to completely replace, which is a significant amount of dollars. We're looking to raise anywhere between $250,000 and $300,000 based on the concept drawings. I'm sure you can imagine this is far beyond the scope of what we can ask our parents. Our parents at Pucker, as I'm sure all the parents at 58 are very generous with our PTA, so we need to go outside of the normal fundraising methods. We're here tonight to ask the board's approval to begin raising money under a 503c corporation. The officers are here in the room this evening. The sole purpose of the organization is to raise funds to be dispersed for the replacement of the playground equipment, at which time the organization will be dissolved and its mission will be complete. We put together, so far, $6,500 in donations from community members outside and from within our PTA, but this, again, is separate from our PTA. We've set up a couple of social sites for fundraising that have not yet been launched. Again, we're waiting for approval from the board to begin raising funds. The 503C allows us, of course, to offer tax deductions to large corporations that will be hopefully sharing their funds with us. Mr. McDaniel said we're trying to shorten our timeline to get to this endpoint. I'm committed to no timeline publicly, but we're going to try our darndest to get as much as possible to get this done. At the very least, well, many of our kids on the board are still at school. As part of our fundraising efforts, we need to look professional in front of a professional organization. We put together a brochure, and Mr. Circus is going to share with you a video that was put together by Andrew Kubich with his own time and efforts. So we'll direct your attention to the screens for a moment. Well, as I'm sure you can imagine, it's very dramatic music. And it's intended to inspire those that are of the belief that, you know, that education is a course of the mind and the body. As this is going, I do want to take this opportunity to thank everybody that's been on the committee and donated their time, but very specifically our faculty, Mr. McDaniel, Mr. Kupich, of course, Mrs. Hurkitz, Ms. Kadar as well. Thank you so much for your time. This goes above and beyond what we need to do for our children's education. They really do have our kids' education in mind, but also the facilities that our kids have available to them. So thank you all publicly. Mr. Kubich put together a wonderful audio track. It required no licenses to use whatsoever. And with that, any questions?
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for doing that.
All right, next up are communications. Listed on tonight's agenda are 18 communications received by the board. Are there any additional communications board members would like to share at this time?
Wait.
Vote on
the playground?
Do we have to accept anything?
No.
Can they certify one CPO themselves?
They can. We had started a couple of years back, the board will recall, when we had our first approach from our community wanting to do some fundraising. We wanted to make sure that the board was aware of that effort and willing to support it. Moving forward, the action that would be taken would be on the contract approval, okay, as happened with Hillcrest. If there were any concerns or questions, this would be the time that I know the committee would love to hear those from the board. And if not, then the committee can move forward with with their fundraising efforts and then continue to give us updates.
Just want to make sure we didn't have to hold them up for another meeting.
No, it's not. Thank you very much.
Right, thanks.
Thank you. Okay, sorry, John.
Next up, our reports to the board. The first one will be the superintendent report, Dr. Crumscombe.
Absolutely. Thank you. I have a few things to report to the board and our community as well. First of all, I would like to thank the board for the curriculum workshop that we held recently, as well as the extended reception of visitors. I think that was a really nice opportunity for the board to engage with our community, hear some feedback, but also answer some questions. As the board is aware, some of our administrators were asked to follow up with a couple of items and have accomplished those follow-up items as well, so thank you for that opportunity. We do have a financial workshop coming up, and following suit with our curriculum workshop, I would assume that the board would like to also have that extended reception of visitors opportunity, but wanted to affirm that with the board, so as we build that agenda, we can make sure to provide for that opportunity again. And as you'll hear a little bit later in the agenda, we're also looking to do a possible candidates forum at that time. We have a few seats open on the board coming up for the April election, and so anyone who might be interested in learning a little bit more about that board, what it's like to be a member of the school board, that may be held in conjunction with that. Again, you'll hear a little bit more about that later on this evening. So that is November 28th for those who are looking forward to that. In terms of our optional kindergarten enrichment and enhancement program, I just wanted to give the board an update on that. At this point, our teachers have continued to do their curriculum review and update in that regard. Our payments are up to date across the district. We're really proud of that. That was one of the concerns that the board had in opening that program, because there are some fees associated with participation there. Our principals and our school secretaries have been doing just an outstanding job making sure that families are notified of those payments that are due, and those have been coming in regularly. So thank you also to the community for participating in that. We heard at the last board meeting a little bit about the Henry Pupper OKEEP program, which was nearing capacity, and I'm proud to report that we've had a few more students enroll there, so we were able to open that second section. So that has been a great addition at Henry Puffer School as well. Parent-teacher conferences are being hosted this week. So it's nice to see so many teachers out tonight. They're going to have a couple more long nights this week. We did do a new sign-up kind of format this year. We've had a couple of glitches with that. For the most part, it has streamlined some of our parent logins, but we've had to work through a couple of glitches here and there. So thank you for everyone who's helped with that. November 10th, last Thursday, we held our Teacher Institute Day over at O'Neill. That was a really nice day. The feedback we've received thus far has been very positive about that learning opportunity. There were a variety of topics that were covered on that day. Some were trainings provided by our own staff, supporting their colleagues or collaborating with their colleagues. Some were provided by our principals in building level meetings. There was some STEM learning opportunities as well. So overall, it was a really good learning day for our staff. We did collect some feedback, and so we'll look forward to reviewing that as well as we plan for our next Institute Day. On that note, and as we've heard tonight, there's been so much change over the last 5 years. Our staff is really, I think, feeling it at this point. We have a lot to be proud of, but there's also been a whole lot of change, and that has certainly had an impact on our staff as they continue to work really hard. And I just want to take a moment to appreciate everyone's hard work, our teachers, our principals, our administrators. It hasn't been easy over the last 5 years. We've had a lot of change happening in this district in terms of certainly our facilities, but our new programs. When you look back, we've adopted one-to-one. We've rolled out MAP, which was new to our district. And now looking back, it's hard to imagine. It's only been here really 4 years. Our OKEEP and our Biliteracy, our RISE program, all of those things have been new to our staff, and sometimes that's hard to keep up with. And so that has it's had an impact, and we're trying to support our staff as we make those adjustments moving forward and provide some of that professional development that we heard some good things about this evening as well. So thank you to everyone for that.
Moving forward, we have some surveys that will be opening up. We know annually we do surveys with our students, with our staff, and with our parents. Those are those environmental surveys, as well as what is now the state-mandated survey, the five essentials. And so parents will be receiving emails about that. Our teachers and our students will be participating in those as well. So we look forward to getting that feedback. The Science Fair registration, if you haven't heard, opened up, and we've been receiving some registrations for that. So please go ahead and log on and get your child registered if you haven't already. And I'm very proud to report our Reading Games program opened, registration for that program opened, and very swiftly filled up. It filled in about 21 minutes.
Whoa.
So for any parents who were really, it's amazing. And again, that's another new program. There's so many opportunities throughout our district for students to engage in enrichment or learning activities beyond the school day, and it truly is a tribute to not only our teachers but also our parents who are helping to facilitate so many of those opportunities now. So for that registration completely to fill within 21 minutes is pretty impressive. So thank you to everyone who has a hand in that and who will have a hand in that. We know that there's a large volunteer need to make sure that program runs well, as with the science fair as well. So if you're not familiar, we do need people to volunteer to be judges at the science fair as well. So both of those activities require a huge community effort, and we hope that people will volunteer to support that as well. With that, I think that concludes my report. I appreciate everyone being there. Thank you.
Thank you, Kerr.
Next
up is a monthly business. David?
Thank you. After last month's significant jump in revenue due to bulk of our property tax receipts coming in, this past month our revenues are dropped down to a relatively normal level. Our expenditures continue apace as they normally do. Since our last board meeting, I did have two additional investments that had matured. As I had mentioned at our last meeting, I did reinvest them. Unfortunately, interest rates still are not all that awesome. They were at an average of 0.875%. I'm interested in moving a couple accounts out of U.S. Bank, and I anticipate bringing forward a recommendation next month for you to approve switching our medical reserve account from U.S. Bank over to Community Bank in Downers. I'm expecting that to save between $700 and $900 per month in fees. So I think that's a good move. And I expect that our cafeteria account then will also move sometime in the few months after that. I would make a recommendation on that either to Community Bank or to MB. So you've already approved all three of them as depositories. I'm just trying to make the best mix of them for the benefit of the district and the taxpayers. We're currently in the process of bidding our special education transportation. We expect to have a recommendation at our next board meeting. It's unknown right at this point what the impact will be on our cost structure. Our hope is that we will have improved service at the same or lower cost. So more to come as we get to this next month with that recommendation. We're also bidding our single student or small student transport, we often think of as cab or taxi transport, as well, and we'll have a recommendation for that as well at the next meeting. Tomorrow is, I know you've been waiting for this, it is the beginning of the veto session in the General Assembly. One of the bills that is potentially available to be passed is Senate Bill 2912. This is a bill that would ease the shortage of substitute teachers and streamline teacher licensing reciprocity with other states. This last spring, it did pass the Senate, but it wasn't called for a vote in the House. I'm hopeful that our representatives will hear from their constituents that we support Senate Bill 2912 and the ability that it would do to provide more substitutes and help deliver educational services for our students. I also mentioned that earlier this month, I did have a meeting, breakfast meeting, it wasn't just me, there was others there as well, with a number of local representatives. And what I continue to hear is that a pension cost shift is likely going to be part and parcel of any type of education funding reform package that might get passed through the General Assembly. And it's possible that we might see something in both in either the veto session or perhaps more likely the lame duck session in January. That you know, with our certified staff costs in the 25 to 30 million range, you know, we could be looking at about a $2 to $2.5 million impact per year on the district cost structure once that cost is fully transferred over to the district. Our hope is that if it does get transferred, it would be phased in over time. Of course, right now, it's hard to say that what will, if anything, happen out of the General Assembly and really what that would look like. There are some different ideas that some representatives have on what that might look like in the hope to get something in place before it just sort of happens through some of the work by Michael Madigan. So I just want to share that with you just for your insight, and with that, I'll conclude my report. Thank you.
Thank you. And what we've learned from the state is never hold your breath. It won't happen.
Next up is the Policy Committee. The policy met on October 18, 2016. Sally, fill us in.
We had two policies that we took a look at that are up for first review by the board this month. The first one was policy 5150.2, which was revised in order to conform with the Youth Sports Concussion Safety Act, and the changes that the board has received in the packets are modeled off of the Press ISB model policy. So there were those changes for your review. The other policy that we took a look at was policy 8022, internal board operations, recognizing that some of us have emergencies or work obligations that pull us away. We thought it might be prudent to come up to date, I suppose, with the 21st century and let, as appropriate, board members call in for board meetings. The language that is there conforms with the language that is in the Open Meetings Act. So that's the second item.
Thank you. So next up is the first reading of policy 5150.2, students, student-athlete concussions and head injuries, as recommended by the policy committee. Is there a motion to approve for first reading policy 5150.2 regarding student-athlete concussions and head injuries and place it on the December board agenda for final approval?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion is carried to approve the first reading of policy 5150.2 and place it on the December board agenda for final approval. Next is first reading of policy 8022, internal board operation meetings, as recommended by the policy committee. Is there a motion to approve for first reading policy 8022 regarding meetings and place it on the December board agenda for final approval?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion is carried to approve the first reading of policy 8022 and place it on the December board agenda for final approval. Next would be the Legislative Committee, which met November 8, 2016. John Miller.
Okay. In your board documents, you have the 2016 Resolutions Committee report. The committee spent most of the time discussing the resolutions, and they recommend that our representative would vote in favor as they are written. So we're just looking for some feedback now. If any board members had any strong feelings one way or the other, or would like us to change any of those recommendations, or if the IASB recommendations are good to vote the district yes or no, depending on for or against.
Nobody has anything.
Okay. All right. Well, that was okay. The other big topic was starting the planning process for the legislative breakfast, working on some dates. With that, obviously, we were waiting until the election was over to don't want to necessarily send out invitations to people that will no longer be in office. So we will get those dates out and publicized as soon as we know what fits their schedule. You know, and we did recognize that with the current Illinois legislature kind of not really being cohesive,
Who knows when they're going to be available or not available. But that's always a good breakfast. I think a lot of good contact comes out of that, and it's an opportunity for the district to at least in person make our feelings known of what we want in Springfield. And we've had our congressional or U.S. congressional representatives there. We've had Roskin and Foster there in the past, too. So that was the bulk of what we talked about there. Any questions? Oh, yeah.
Thank you, John. The Financial Advisory Committee did not meet in November. Next would be the Meet and Confer Strategic Plan Committee. Elizabeth Siegel, can you give us an update?
So Doug and I, you know, really been talking about this a lot since the board gave us direction to start working through this. We've come up with what we think are three main goals for the committee, the first of which is to provide an avenue for communication with a number of, I don't want to, of our stakeholders, a number of the main groups within our district and our community in general, to have a way for us to get some feedback and begin thinking about our strategic plan. And as we're looking ahead to our strategic plan, which is, you know, not recently done, and starting to look towards what will be a very large effort to perhaps go through that and begin this next strategic planning process, to bring in the right people in the room to start thinking through how that process might work and how we can all work together on that initiative. So we've taken these 3 points on the road quite a bit the last couple of weeks. We've met with a number of our different constituent groups, including Doug and I talking at the PTA President's Council last week. We've met individually with a number of representatives of our various unions. Carrie has brought our document around to some of the main groups as well to make sure everybody seems to agree with the objectives and wants to be part of the process. So the next step really is to look to our board members and say, does that make sense? Is what we're doing something that everyone's in agreement with? And if so, are you okay with us having our kickoff meeting in 2 weeks as a get everybody together and make sure we're all on the same page, make sure we know who the right people are, and then we would be able to come back to you at our December meeting with a proposed list of members of the committee. I know it's a little backwards to have the meeting before we can appoint people to the committee, but we really felt like it was important to get the right people together in the room, make sure that everybody knew what they were signing up for before they officially signed up for it and committed to what will probably be a monthly commitment over the next year as we start to work through a lot of these issues and bringing the right people together in the room. Our hope is to be able to fit everybody in this room, so try and keep the group to 20 or less, but then bring in the right people as we need to over time as we're talking about specific issues. We might want to bring in other people. Did I take it all the main points?
You got it. I think that there's everybody. We just want everybody on the board to feel comfortable with the direction that we're going, and of course we'll report back next month after our first meeting to let you know how it goes. And we do have a few people, or we're trying to get a few people from every group to be involved.
Hey, have you reached out to the Chamber of Commerce?
I have not.
Mind some of that.
That's a good idea. Let's do that. You know, when we did the super retreat of all the different elected officials, we had some. I had some one-off conversations just about ways we could work together. I think Chamber of Commerce and perhaps 99 as well. I don't know whether they need to be at the first meeting, but I think that they're important people to include as we go through, so we can have those conversations, absolutely.
That's a good idea.
I just want to make sure we cover the full spectrum to make
absolutely
sure that we are consistent with board policy.
And I think the other big thing that maybe we didn't make clear is our expectation is we would follow all of the Open Meetings Act, that this would be a posted meeting, and everybody, anyone who wants to come is obviously welcome at 7 a.m. on December 6th.
Drink coffee.
Coffee?
I don't drink coffee. I'll have my Diet Coke. You all fend for yourself.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you guys for that.
Beautiful, thank you.
Next up are discussion items. The first would be the demographer's report. Carrie, I'll hand it to you.
The photographer is here somewhere because he was meeting with us in the administrative team and the principals prior to this meeting. Someone may need to just signal him. Dr. McKibben comes to us to offer his forecast, not projections, which he clarified for us in our prior meeting, and give us some insight about what he sees happening throughout our community currently and moving forward as well. So, Dr. McKibben, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen of the board. These are not just here. It's just gone without us. You have a full report on this. This is the PowerPoint presentation of it. I believe the full report will be up on the district's website. I guarantee you will hear any case of insomnia you have in your life. So. Okay. Dr. Camilli mentioned, these are forecasts. They are not projections. Two different things, real quickly. A projection for you take a past trend, usually year-to-year survivorship, second to third, third to fourth, over four, five, six, 7 years, create an algorithm and apply it to your current enrollment and the future. Okay, very easy, very simple to use, very cheap. For a long, long time, all we have until like the mid-90s. The problem with it is it's almost never right. I mean, it's a very bold assumption. What's happened in the past will replicate itself in the future, which almost never happens. A forecast is where you build forecasted models. In this case, population demographic. We do a full population forecast for each of the elementary 10 cities. Fertility, mortality, migration, household structure, family composition, in and out composition of migration rates. Do this population forecast, and the results of that population forecast then drive an enrollment forecast. We'll go through this in presentation. Okay? So the action is really in the pop forecast. And to really understand what's going to happen in an area, you have to understand the demographic dynamics and what your population characteristics are. Now, anytime you do a forecast, you have those assumptions. Okay? Broad socioeconomic demographic characteristics. If these assumptions hold true, the forecast should stay at the district level within 2% of our forecast line. Next slide. And there's a bunch of them. I'm going to go through the three key ones. Okay. Probably the most important one is this. Interest rates, historic low. The 30-year fixed mortgage stays below 5%. Why is this so important? Very, very simple. You don't have enough births in the district every year to keep your enrollment constant. Right now, your first grade cohorts average about 540. You're averaging anywhere between 350 and 400 births a year. So every year you need, in that individual cohort, about 100 to 150 kids moving into the district. More on that later. 80% of your housing market is existing home sales. Tear downs, new home construction, that's just great. You can build 500 new homes a year in the district. If you don't sell any existing homes, your enrollment drops. Very, very simple. Now, to those of us old people, that remember the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, where the 30-year fixed rate was about 7, 8, 9, 10%. 5 still sounds pretty good. To the youngsters today, and my definition of youngster now is anybody below 40, you're seeing nothing but 3, 3.5, 4%. 5 sounds like highway robbery. Okay? It's a very, very psychological aspect. And remember, okay, you may have seen that a very key article came out the last couple of months where the average college graduate comes out of school with $35,000 student loan debt. What the article didn't tell you was the average college graduate marries a college graduate. Try $70,000 in household debt. That's why the mortgage approval rate is only running about 62. It was in the low 90s during the housing boom. It got down to about 38% during the bust. We've gotten back up to 72. Now, we've used this 5% tipping point. Everything you have a percentage as an assumption is a tipping point. If it goes to 5.1, 5.2, stays there for a couple months, drops back down, it's a slight drag in the forecast. If it goes to 7%, stays there for a couple months, it's like hitting a brick wall. You will see your housing market slow down dramatically, and I will be the first person to tell you my forecast will be too high. Guarantee it. That's a very, very key parameter. It's of great concern right now because after seeing 30-year fixed rates for the last 8 years between 3 and 4.25%, we've seen a half point rise in 6 days. So that's probably, if you're looking at the short-term variable for changes in assumption violations, that's the one to be tracking. Other one I want to point out is your unemployment rate. If it stays below 7.7%, goes to 7.1, 7.2, stays for a couple months, drops down, slight drag. Goes back up to 12% unemployment like we had in 2009. People don't buy houses when they don't have a job. It's going to be a drag on the forecast, it's a second drag. And then the next sheet, probably the third most important one, housing turnover rates will remain at current levels, existing majority of existing homes over the age of 60. When you look at people downsizing their homes, you see a slight uptick at 62, you see another one at 65. But the majority of households don't downsize till they're in their 70s. It's not retirement that fires downsizing. It's the death of one of the spouses. Then the house is too big, too much maintenance, you're rattling around, the kids say you're downsizing, you're close to us, move close to them, whatever. That's when the homes go on the market. So if I know percent of housing units and homeowners over age 65, that's your best local area proxy measurement of how many homes are going to go on the market in the next 10 years. And that will vary from a tenant area to a tenant area. There are some other ones. Those are the key ones that sound like I got 20 minutes to do. Okay, next slide. The power of GIS. Our partner company, Cropper GIS, Columbus, Ohio, does GIS work. I did the demographic. Matt Cropper, really, really nice guy, great geographer, does great work. Only one personality flaw is he went to Ohio State. If you overlook that, you're okay. Okay. We just geocode the students, and for years, we always had the methodology to do small area forecasts. We just didn't have the data, the technological knowledge to pull it off. With geocoding, you can put the students back in their home attendance area. Like in this particular, this is the map for Kingsley. You have 70 students that attend that live outside the attendance area, 10 that live in, that go someplace else. When you put everybody back in their home attendance area, you can then correlate changes to that number of students to demographic, socioeconomic variables in that individual area. It's also great when you're trying to do planning, too, when you see how many kids are going from attendance area to attendance area. So all of the students were geocoded. This data was made available to us by attendance area, so we can do our demographic analysis. Next slide. This is a population pyramid, okay? I learned many, many years ago, if I start with a list of numbers, people go to sleep. With the graph here, think of this as your demographic fingerprint. No two geographic areas have the exact size and shape of their population pyramid. Each area in the attendance area has a pop pyramid in your report, and you will notice that none of them look exactly like this. This is how we first start picking up the individual characteristics. And they're really easy to read. Now, they're from the 2010 census. Now, the first thing you think is, God, that six-year-old data, what good is it? Well, I'll get to that later. It's actually very good data. 0 to 4, that's your preschool age cohorts. 5 to 9, it's elementary, middle, high school. 20 to 34 years old, that's what we call family formation ages. 80% of all births occur in women between the ages of 20 and 34 years old. This is where you start your families. 35 to 54 years old, these are the households of people who have kids in school. 55 to 69, we call empty nest households. 70 and over are the turnover population. Now I'm going to keep using a term here called empty nest households, which traditionally we think about when the last kid graduates high school. This district is when the last kid leaves eighth grade. So you need to expand your definition of empty nesters. There's a lot of households in the district that still have school-age kids in them, at least not in elementary grade or middle school. So now, if nothing had happened, everybody had stayed put the last 5 years, nobody moved in, nobody moved out, your elementary enrollment would have dropped by about 300 students. Why? because the grade cohort, the age cohorts coming behind it, 0 to 4, are smaller. They have a deficit. Very, very common in suburban areas where you have very few people in child-rearing ages. You'll have this deficit. Now, if you have enough households move in and bring preschool-age kids with them and build the size of those cohorts, you'll break even. Okay? That's why in-migration and the housing market is so important for suburban districts. Okay? So, my year enrollment, elementary enrollment, didn't drop by 300. So, clearly, you had a amount of in-migration. I think it's going to vary from area to area. You also don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure out that your fastest growing household type in the next 10 years will be empty nest households. Your number of households going into their 70s will also increase rather dramatically at the same time as the front end of the peak of the baby boom starts turning 70. The question is, by attendance area, will this increase be fast enough to offset this increase in empty nesting? And that comes to your basic problem. You can have wonderful schools and all that, but if people don't have a place to move into, they can't move in and bring their kids with them. So it's a number of households on the market that's your key variable. It's going to vary by area to area. I want to go quickly on two examples of elementary areas. Next slide. Bel Air, okay. This large bubble of 20 to 24 is college. It's group quarter, you pull them out of the analysis. But again, a rather substantial deficit in the 0 to 4. But fortunately, this now late 50s and early 60s, a rather growing number of households turning over. This is why housing, the house market dynamics are so key to this. It's going to tell us how many households are going to turn over. But there's very, very few non-college people living in the area. So they can't depend on what we call indigenous births to create the next cohort. You know, you have to have in-migration. The first grade cohort of 2022 is being born this year. Okay? So as Lynn was pointing out during an earlier presentation, you've got to remember, every child that's attending Downers Grove schools right now will be out of the district by the end of these forecasts. We're looking at an entire different generation that's going to come in. And if I may have the board's indulgence for a second, I'll do a quick survey here. How many people here currently have children enrolled in Downers Grove School District? Just raise your hand. Okay? How many of you going to have any more kids? You got a mighty task in front of you. Mighty task. That's the fundamental problem. The households that are putting kids in the school district now are not going to be the households putting more kids in 5-10 years from now. Now, a more important question. As soon as your last child graduates high school, how many are you going to sell your house and leave the district? Not enough.
It depends.
Not enough. Okay? And that's the problem. You know, it's your home. It's your community. You like it here. So those housing units are out of the picture for at least a 10-year duration. They're not going to have any more kids, and they're not going to move away. And that sets the tone for what the dynamics are going to be. So we have to look at these households that will turn it over, people who will have more kids. Next slide. El Sierra, that's a retirement community. We pull that out too. It's a whole different dynamic. People move in at age 65, they die. More people move in at 65 is not really the equation. It's not part of that turnover population we're looking for. Okay, but a much more pillar type. You don't have big ebbs and flows in the population distribution. And because of that, you don't see near the size of the deficit. So an area like El Sierra actually would need fewer households turning over, fewer households moving in, just to break even. The bigger the deficit, the more households you need moving in just to break even. And that's a common problem because you go out in the community, you see households moving in, you see new families, you see some tear-down building going on. Oh, I see all these households going in. And you instinctively want to add it to what you already have. Not realizing those preschool age cohorts coming in behind it might be, it probably are smaller than an area like this. So you have to fill in the deficit first, then you have growth. Next slide. These are some of the key characteristics we look at by its elementary attendance area. shock for most people, less than a third of your housing units have under 18 population. That's not school age, it's under 18. Only about 25% of your households have school age population in it. Sidebar, that's why people have such a hard time getting school bonds passed these days. Okay? 2.51 average household size. Real gross, real rough estimation. Mom, dad, what the point is kids. Okay? It's about half a kid per household on average. And a pretty wide range between the areas. You've seen some of the 2.4s, some of the 2.3s. I'll go over here for the board. As high as 2.8. It doesn't sound like a whole lot of difference, but a point one difference in this area, 5,000 households, that's 500 people. So small changes, small differences in the person per household has a big impact. Most of that impact is children. Next slide. Homeowners age 35-54, these are the households that have kids in school, 40%. The good news is 25% of the households over age 25. So you have a relatively large number of households that will be turning over in the next 2 years. That's good news because those houses go on the market that allows new young households to move in. And then majority homeowners, about 3/4, you have some outliers, not surprisingly, El Sierra, Indian Trail, Whittier, have some apartments, which is actually good. That's good family formation areas. If householders come in and move and start their households in an apartment, they're most likely to stay, like the community. Outliers, Bel Air at 89%, Highland 83%, 85% at Hillcrest, dominated by homeowners. The dynamics of renters and owners are completely different. Renters tend to be younger, homeowners tend to be older. Renters move an average of every 18 months, homeowners every 9.5 years. Renters tend to still be having kids from family formation. Homeowners tend to have finished their family formation. Most people don't go drop $400,000 or $500,000 on a new house and say, hey, hon, let's have another kid. This doesn't work that way. Okay? Once you buy that house, it's your money's all tied up in that. So homeownership is a very, very key variable. Next slide, please. Okay. 27% of the households are single person. Don't see many kids in single person households. But fortunately, 11% single person over 65, that's householders in most cases, we pulled out the group quarters elderly, homeowners will be turning over again, a good sign there's more households turning over the next 10 years that allow young households to move in. The question becomes, will it be fast enough? Will it be a big enough turnover to compensate for the growing number of empty nest households? That becomes the key variable. Next slide. Okay. This is my favorite one. This goes back to that 2010 data being so bad. This is individual year of age by attendance area. And what we can do is we can look at the relative cohort size in 2010. 5-year-olds, that was kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth, fifth. In 2015, that's your kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth, fifth. And we can see the relative size of the cohort and match it up to the number of kids that lived in the area. We call it your market share. And we can see if you have a year-to-year change, if it's a real demographic change, is it real in-migration or out-migration, or is it a big or small cohort. A great example here is Lester, okay? 105, 5-year-old, 94, boom, drops to 75, pops back up to 92, back down to 79, goes back up. So you got a lot of variation in there. So if you have year-to-year changes, oh, you have a big first-grade cohort coming in, must have people moving in. No, it could be this. Until you look at that, you're trying to isolate what are the actual changes, what are real demographic changes, what are being caused by your housing market. Now, I fully expect 6 years from now to see this giant spike in Chicago area burst because of the Cubs winning. You know? I don't know. Yeah, I would be there anyway. Okay. This, we do this for each individual attendance area. There you go. Now, I want to show you the example at the district level how this market share works. Okay, here's the next slide. There you go. What you do is you match up the enrollment, okay, on 2012. The three-year-olds in 2010 are now five-year-olds. That's your kindergarten cohort. That's your first grade, second, third, fourth, fifth. What you do is track that through time. Now, you always see it pop from kindergarten to first grade. Why? Because not all kids go to kindergarten. But the first grade, that's where you tend to have 100% participation. If the percentages go up, you've had in-migration. And we can then measure that empirically and compare it to home sales, home building, migration trends, things like that. And you can generalize that to household characteristics because it's been my experience over the years that when a third grader moves, they tend to take the whole family with them. So you take that leap of logic. And you can see here, you've had a rather healthy and substantial in-migration flow. No argument to that at all. The problem is, here is your size of your cohorts in 2012, kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth, fifth. Here's your cohort sizes in 2016, first, second, third, fourth, fifth. Pretty much in the five teens, five twenties, except for this one pop here, these are mostly in the 570s. We call it the cohort effect. We'll get more to that later. So you have heavy in-migration. You've got lots of young families moving in. Is it enough to make up for that preschool deficit? That becomes the key question. Cut to the end, the answer is almost. Not quite. Close. Real close. Better than a lot of your neighbors. It's not quite there. Again, you can see this from the 2010 counts. You're up in the close to 600 here. You're down the low 500s. That's a lot of territory to make up. You can't have any more 2009, 2010 births. Once you're done with the year, it has to be done with migration. Next slide. This is the population forecast. Everybody, there's one for each attendance area. Now, people always just pass this and go right to the enrollment forecast. Don't do that. This is where the action's at. Okay? There's two ways to read this. You can check a 5 and 9 cohort across time. That's basically your elementary age. Or you can track a cohort through time. The 0 to 4 are now 5 to 9, are now 10 to 14, 15 to 19. So you can see it's growth. We've got forecasted in-migration going there. No argument there. The question is it enough to make up for the deficit? Is it enough to make up for your graduating 8th grade going on to high school? These are what we call the components of change. You have births, deaths, natural increase, net migration, change. This is for 10 to 15, 15 to 20, 20 to 25. Births are dropping slightly. Why are they dropping slightly? Fewer people prime childbearing age. Fertility rates haven't moved more than 10% band in the last 40 years. Changes in year-to-year birth is due to number of women childbearing age, not to changes in the fertility rate. The deaths are going up. It's not because there's a plague here or anything. It's because you just have more people, we call them the prime dying age. I know we have to find a better term than that, but we're calling it right now. It's an older population. Your median age goes from 42 to 49. Or it's 44, okay? It's an older population. Now, a lot of people sit there and go, 760 net in-migrants over the last 5 years. I know there's been more people move in than that, and you're right. There has been. It's net migration. Number of people moving in, minus number of people moving out, okay? What's your out-migration flow? High school students, 33 down 27, okay? You're suffering from what I call the curse of successful school districts. Everybody goes on to post-secondary education, goes off to college, doesn't move back. For every 2 high school seniors that leave the district and don't come back, you need 1 new household to come in just to break even on fertility. So you have to make up that deficit. You've actually got probably about 3,700 moving in, about 3,000 moving out. Your second out-migration flow, of course, is elderly. but it's very, very consistent flow. There's inflow and there's outflow. The results of the POP forecast for each individual attendance area drives the enrollment forecast. Okay. Here's the forecast population change for an area, 1.9, 1.3 for the 2 5-year periods. Pretty consistent, which you'd expect for an area with this kind of population age distribution. Next one is the actual enrollment forecast. All right, now, on the cohort effect, the analogy I use is a bucket of water. You have a bucket of water, I'm pouring water at the top, and there's a hole in the bottom. If I'm pouring in faster than it's going out the bottom, the level goes up. If for some reason the hole in the bottom gets bigger and it's going out faster than I'm pouring in, the level will drop. Okay. Enrollment works the same way. What's the size of the cohorts coming in? What's the size of the cohorts going out? And a great example, just recently, in your own enrollment here, look at your 8th grade cohorts going out. You're looking at the change. You had a big drop here in 2014. Why? You had a big cohort going out and a relatively small one coming in. Okay, and that's where you see this variation. Now, fortunately, you've got a big cohort going out this year, almost 600 kids, and almost 600 next year, but then it drops off. 536, 504, and then it crawls back up again. That's why you see this wave pattern going through. It depends on the cohort size. You'll notice I don't have your kindergarten, or excuse me, your first grade cohort dropping that much. Okay? You're still going to have a strong in-migration flow and a strong housing market. It's just not there. You need these numbers to be consistently above 550, year in and year out, to break even. They're just not quite there. That's why you see this real, real slight decline. Years you have small cohorts going out, you see a slight increase. Years you have big cohorts going out, you see a slight decrease. Okay? But you're just about breaking even. Now, having said this, and your report has a forecast for each individual attendance area, these trends will vary from area to area. The areas that have more houses turning over, smattering of teardowns and buildings, that kind of helps, but a lot of that's along the railroad tracks, but that's just for specific areas. But the bread and butter variable there is how many households are turning over. There's a great way you can check that. We use Realty Track and Zillow. You write down the parcel level. Most people don't realize everything about your house, public domain data. I encourage you to go home tonight when you're done. Use Realty Track. Type in your address and see who your friends and neighbors are behind on the mortgage. Great way to spice up next cocktail party. See who's on the market, how long it's been on the market for, what's it selling for, you know. These people lie to your neighbors about how much you got for your house. Can't do that anymore now. All into that, you know. You may have wanted 600, you've got 450, so. And that's a very key variable, is what they're selling the houses for. There's a very, very important rule in demography. You can have money, you can have kids, but you can't have both. So as house price goes up, kids per household go down. And as house price goes up, the older the kids tend to be when they move in that household. If it's a $400,000 house, there might be some preschoolers. Might even have one child afterward. If it's a $600,000-$800,000 house, they're probably done. Now, there are exceptions to that. You know, some people have kids older. I was a first-time father at 40. You know, it does happen. But when I went to my son's things at high school, they told me what a nice, well-behaved grandson I had. So not that many of us. Must be an older crowd here. They find that funny. 19 minutes.
Wow.
Are there any questions? Of course not. I know this is a lot of material to process.
Thank you. I always find this fascinating, personally.
Yeah. It is. Yeah, it is. You know, what they think is a fun job is no two school districts are exactly alike. Always something different. And I was talking about this earlier with Dr. Scully. every demographic trend in the country is going on someplace in this district. This has got to be one of the most diverse, particularly suburban districts I've seen outside of California, and California doesn't count, you know, so they're all, you know, there anyway. It's a fascinating district. It's just, you know, everything here. You got Gen Xers coming in. You got old, stodgy people my age. You know, you got empty nesters. You got people who've been here for generations. The immigrant population has been scattered all over the place. So it really is just a fascinating place to study. Not bad restaurants either, my friend.
How do you forecast in the school attendance areas that have the high apartment versus housing?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because, again, it's kind of one of those real quickly. Apartments are a real key variable on that. The first thing I look at apartments, one, the occupancy rate. Okay. The second thing I look at is the rent because it works the same way as houses. If the rent is $800 to $900 a month, you're going to see a lot of preschool kids. People, as a rule, start to have their families in apartments. Once the oldest child gets to kindergarten, first grade, definitely second one, they're looking to that single-family attached home. People that have the economic resources don't want to raise their kids in an apartment, as a rule. Okay. But the other thing I look at with apartments is, say you build 400 apartments, how many of them are two or three bedrooms? Studio apartments and one-bedroom apartments give you virtually nothing in the way of kids. There's no place to put them. You know? So we're building 400 apartments. Okay, how many get two or three bedrooms? Well, only 50 units. Okay, well, that's what I'm going to look at. Then I'm going to look at price. The problem there comes in, if you have a two or three-bedroom apartment, now you start looking at rents are going $1,200, $1,400, $1,600, depending on the unit. And the gap between what you're paying in rent and what you might pay for a mortgage per month, a single family attached home starts to close. And the closer that is, you see more of the movement coming out. Okay? So as a rule, over a five-year period, most of those households will move out. As I said earlier, the average rental property turnover will move every 18 months on average. So you have to look at these individual variables. No two apartment complexes are the same. I mean, condos and townhouses are a whole other animal there, too. So, now, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your perspective, there's some rental in the area, concentrated like three attendance areas, but it's not enough to really turn your demographic trend because it's basically driven by single-family detached homes that, unfortunately for you right now, the majority of those homeowners are in their 50s. They're too old to have kids. They're too young to move away. You're kind of in that dead zone. No offense, Lex.
Can you go one more slide and just talk about 16? There's some pretty big increases in there.
That slide?
Yeah.
That's the slide everyone's here to see.
Anything particular you'd like? The thing that jumps out to me is you've got 4.4%. District growth of the elementary turned a negative in 2021.
Right.
Okay. And what's happening there is that's really the dead zone. You just don't have enough houses to be turning over after 2021. We talked about this beforehand, too. If we carry these forecasts out five more years, okay, that trend will turn because you're going to have the peak of the boom over 70. And you're going to have all these existing homes dumped on the market. So either one of two things is going to happen. You're going to have a whole bunch of young families move in with kids. It's going to turn your trends back positive. Or they're not going to sell, and you're almost going to go through the floor.
Well, you can see some of that flipping there, because if you look at, you know, Bel Air, the top one, mm-hmm. up 19, and then only up 1.8 yeah. after that. And then even Highland up 22%, which is huge. And then the following five years down to 4.7.
Yeah. It's that balance, and it's going to vary from area to area. That's what I always say, start with the population pyramid. You know, how many are potentially going to turn over in the next 5 years versus how much empty nesting do you have. If you've got very few turning 70 and a whole bunch going in their 50s, that's bad news. But if that gap is small and you've got also the, almost the same number of turning 70s you've got empty nesting in their 50s, that's good.
Right.
Because it goes back to that fundamental basic point. They've got to have some place to live if they're going to move into the area. You know? And tear downs and infill isn't big enough to do it. That's maybe on a good year 75, average year of about 50. You need several hundred, about 400 or 500 a year turning over. Okay? And it's going to vary from area to area. In the short term, Kingsley, Highland, Bel Air, doing pretty good. Okay? But in the end, it all catches up with them. Okay?
And we should note probably that Kingsley's enrollment growth there is primarily due to the biliteracy program growing mm-hmm. over the years as you look closely at some of that special those special programs.
That's a key point. We hold all administrative policies constant. Okay. For two very important reasons. One, I have absolutely no idea what your administrative policies will be in 2019. Okay. Secondly, when you see the changes, they're demographically driven alone. If you go and you change a program from one school to the other, we go back and do the evaluations, you would need to add that impact to the receiving school and subtract it from the school that loses it. Back to the slide a second. Every year, we do this for all of our school districts too. Every year for the next 3 years, we'll call up the districts probably, I don't know, late October, once the series is over, and say, send us your enrollment by grade by school, and we do a performance evaluation. Now, what we'll do is what we'll shoot for here is, you know, you're not going to have 5,045 kids in 2019. I'm good. I'm not that good. Okay? If the assumptions are holding, at the district level, it should be within 2% of that line. Usually we're within like 1% or 0.5%. But if you're within that 2% confidence interval, the assumptions are holding. If something happens, like say by the 30-year fixed rate goes to 6% next year, I should be too high. Okay? It's not so much being wrong. Why are you wrong, and where is the error affecting it? We do these performance evaluations and keep the district apprised that you're tracking or you're not tracking. Here are problem areas where you're good to go. We do this with all of our districts. Now, the worst thing that ever happened in my career, a couple of years back, Penn Harris, Mass., outside of South Bend, Indiana, 3 years in the forecast of 12,248 students. 3 years in, they had 12,248 students on the nose. Now, why is that the worst thing ever happened to me? Because ever since then, the board's expected the same level of accuracy ever since then. Makes them off by 9 students. 900% increased error. We're paying for this?
If you go to
if
you go to the next slide, then, because that answers my next question. If we're looking, let's say, Bel Air, 238 to 284, because that's one of the things we're going to be looking at as we try and make some decisions across the district, you're feeling 2 to 5% confidence error rate in that we could, I mean, because those are some pretty big jumps.
The school is 3%.
The school is 3%. I mean, that's sort of what I want to understand, is what sort of plus or minus we should be factoring in, because that's still, I mean, 50 plus or minus 5.
At the district level, that's it's about 100 students. If we stay within the 1% band, we usually hit about 50. At the school level, like take Bel Air, I'm talking 10-inch direction.
Okay, so that's really what I'm understanding. Yeah. 10-inch direction is big, but it's not that big, and that's a pretty big change. Okay. And where we're looking at Leicester, however, 496 to 472, plus or minus 10, it's not as big of a change.
You know, it's all like El Sierra, you know, a very, very tight margin. It's the smallest one. You know, Leicester is at 742,
same as Kingsley, there we're looking, you know, close to 10 here. It's tough, you know. So that's when we go back, the first question we'll ask is, did you move any programs? Did you let more out-of-district kids in? Did a charter school open? Did a charter school close? By the way, there's many charter schools closing as compared to opening at any given time. Union County, North Carolina, 42,000 students, charter school opened. 1,000 students disappeared the next year. Probably the best school district in the state of North Carolina, and they still lost. Those are the kind of factors you're looking at. We don't have a charter opening or closing in our assumptions, by the way.
We're expecting.
Or okay. Private opening and closing. When you're looking at air, the first thing you should ask is not how much, is why is it happening? Why is it wrong? Where is that distribution of air? Okay. Well, we look at the individual attendance areas. If we have high air in I'm just going to pick a couple areas, Puffer and Highland, but not in Kingsley and Westfield, then it's something more micro in that specific area you'd be looking at. Was there more teardowns? Were there more people that put their houses on the market? Some households may be out there going, hey, it's not going to get any better than this. Let's cash in. We got a ton of equity. Let's hit the road, you know. You know, we're using generalities to try to measure what are, in the end, very, very personal financial decisions.
I just wanted to make sure I understood. So if I'm looking at the Puffer line, we're predicting somewhere between 10 and 30 additional students over that time range, right? If I'm doing 15 and 35 additional students.
Right.
So that, because that's the sort of thing we need to be looking at. Right. I just want to make sure I understood the numbers as we're looking at all the schools. And then obviously, as we bring it down to the grade level, as a level of specificity, I assume that then it gets a little wider, right? You don't expect it's going to be accurate at every grade in every school, but at least we have a range when we're looking.
Well, I do.
Well, you might, but I...
if you've got a cohort of 28 kids in the third grade at Hillcrest, you got 44 next year. I want to know why.
Okay.
You know, again, when I see air, the first thing that pops in my mind is why. What has happened? Could it be in migration? Let's see now. That would mean a whole bunch of us move in with kids born in 2007. What's the probability of that happening? Pretty slim. Must be something else. Okay.
That makes sense.
And air analysis is only useful if you can identify the source of the air and why it's happening. So, yeah, the individual grade level, I would be looking at that. That's why we do at the district level by grade. You know, if you see a whole bunch of first graders moving in, it means a whole different issue than a whole bunch of fourth graders moving in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Sorry I kept you over 20 minutes.
I appreciate
that. Thank you. We'll be in touch next October then for first evaluation.
Sooner than
you know, thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is the school board candidate orientation. Elizabeth, any of an update?
Back up. So everyone should have received a copy in their packet of a proposed agenda. The first most important thing is to make sure each of you are comfortable, I guess, with the topics you've been assigned to present. That can easily be moved around. But this agenda, as it was proposed, is very, very similar to the agendas that were used when this district used to do a candidate orientation. Very few changes, except where the changes made sense because what our district does and doesn't do are different. It's also very much in line with the District 99 candidate orientation that's going to be presented the following day. So, Carrie, you and I discussed if somebody can't make it 2 hours on November 28th, they can go to District 99 on November 29th. They'll receive almost the same information and vice versa. If someone from District 99 wants to come to ours, they could go to either. But the real focus is just on a little bit on the election, but what is it to be a school board member, and what are your responsibilities, and what's the commitment, and what are the policies, and a little bit about school finance, although they'll have heard a lot of that because they'll come to the budget workshop, so they'll have heard a lot of that. the main questions I think John and I had for everybody on the board were three. We're still moving forward with this. Still moving forward with this on November 28th, and if so, before or after the budget workshop, that needs to be a decision by the board. And then three, does this agenda seem right? I think if we want things changed, the easiest way to change them is just to relay changes to Pam, and she can easily move things around. I give her full discretion to make those decisions. But those are the real three main questions.
All right. I'll answer.
Okay.
I'm comfortable with it, especially since I'm apparently not assigned a topic.
How did that happen?
Yes.
What?
No.
Yeah, I was trying to figure it out.
Then we have to give you a topic. We have to give you a topic.
Since I have the largest one, Doug, you can share mine.
But I think the timing for me doesn't matter. I can do it before or after.
So the options, so if we did it before, we would do it at 6. How does everyone feel about doing it at 6?
I'm 6. I can't think of 6.
So 6 is not my preference either, because I have a... Does anyone have an objection to doing it after?
I think it's important at the most there. I'm flexible. I can do either one. So.
I can do either one also.
So then we'll do after. So we have the workshop and then the extended reception of visitors and then have this after. And hopefully it's all the same people, so that would work.
How do we judge if anybody's going to be there?
I guess if they come.
We just see. Okay. We won't know until
that
we're
night.
There.
Because everything's changing in terms of the way elections run, and it's all...
Right. We don't know.
We don't know.
Like we used to, yeah. We used to be able to see people.
I hope people come. With four board seats up, it would be great.
Filed, so.
The whole reason for having this on November 28th is because it is before anyone would have to file. And I think that's why District 99 is having theirs on the 29th. I think we all found ourselves wanting to have this session earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with the timing. They're my topics. I can share one with the...
Oh, you have two?
No, I have three.
So then the other thing is Pam has in the past put together a packet of materials that I think are wonderful that explain a lot of abbreviations, and it's all the same things. It's all available online anyway. But when the different committees meet and when the board meetings are and when the different workshops are and all of that, unless anyone has an objection, I was going to ask her to together those same materials, obviously updated, so that we have them available for people who chose to stay. District 99 has also put together a pack of materials that does not in any way overlap with what Pam was doing, so I thought perhaps having copies of their materials available as well. It's a lot of materials from the IASB on what makes an effective school board member, and a little bit on the election, and it has a page on the process of going if you wanted to run. But I don't think they'd have any objection to us just handing out their materials, right? That's why they gave them to us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how many people would come, so I think we just bring materials, and if we don't have enough, we'll follow up with people, but hopefully...
We can always run extra copies.
Right. Okay. So, Pam, in terms of posting it, you know everything. I don't.
I'll post it and it'll
and they will come.
Compliance.
So you post it as a separate meeting immediately following that regular scheduled meeting, or does it fall on the agenda of the regular meeting? Well, I think you're going to get more in fight if it's a separate meeting. If it just isn't the agenda, it might not stick out as much.
Right. It'll have its own separate agenda.
Good. Doug, I'm sorry I didn't assign anything to you.
Okay, he's going to do that.
We'll talk about it. I'll pick up the slack somewhere.
Beautiful. That's all I have on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Any further questions? Next up are the 2016 school report cards. Carrie, I'll lead it to you.
Absolutely. The board will recall, and those members of our community who were present at our curriculum workshop, these report cards were shared along with a wealth of information from some of our curriculum committees as well as our schools. So we are required to present these to the board at a regular meeting of the board. So the fact that we did it at the workshop is timely, but doesn't meet the requirement. So we are also presenting them here again. So nothing different, just meeting the requirement of presenting the report cards.
Thank you. Next up is the first reception of visitors. During the first reception of visitors, comments must pertain to agenda items. This is an opportunity for members of the audience to share comments with the board subject to reasonable constraints, but it's not intended to be a time for members of the public to engage in a dialogue with the board. Issues raised during public participation may be added to future agendas or addressed by the administration staff as appropriate. Criticism of individuals is not in order. In accordance with policies 8022 and 1150, individuals appearing before the board are expected to follow these guidelines. Any person addressing the board shall identify yourself, state your school attendance area, and shall speak as briefly as possible. The board president has authority to determine procedural matters regarding public participation not otherwise in board policy, including time limitations when appropriate. The president is responsible for the orderly conduct of the meeting and shall rule on such matters as to the time allowed for public discussion and the appropriateness of their marks to the subject under consideration. At this time, we're going to go to Laura Gilmartin.
Hi, I'm Laura Gilmartin.
You have a card. She's
saying it's not related to the agenda.
I could turn it into based on the demographics report.
Okay.
I'm just here to represent a foster parent who has an incoming kindergartner who knows that the recommendation last year was for a short-term solution for the OKEEP program at Lester. I spoke last year thanking you for all the consideration that you put into it, and just hoping that that consideration is still being made this year so that those of us who have kindergartners coming know what the plan is.
Well, that was the reason for the demographer's report, or a big part of it, so we are looking at it.
Thank you.
Ed Baker?
Yeah, Ed Baker.
Oh, sorry.
First time at a board meeting, I guess, since the Cubs finally broke through in one series, I can thank it out for the board. just a general statement, really. I think it does pertain to everything. That was a nice, long discussion on the demographics and everything. I actually followed along, so I was surprised and proud of myself staying with it during all those numbers. I just heard a couple things over the last couple of months and talked to parents and teachers. I want to thank all the teachers that are here, and I think we should clap for them. They did a great job. They're in the trenches, and they're there. That's what I equate to. They're in the trenches with the kids, and then when the changes occur in the school district, they're the first ones that have to go through and work with our kids at that level, so we appreciate that. But I was just hearing from parents from a couple of meetings that have gone on before. It didn't sound like a corporate meeting here tonight, so I'm happy that that's not what it looked like to me when I came in person. I did hear some things about that being the case, that it was being run like a 700-employee company and that sort of thing, so I just want to make sure that with my eyes and my ears, I didn't see that. So I didn't see that today, so I'm glad that that's not the case. But my concern is, is twofold, that everybody here is working for the best interests of our kids, all of our kids, and we all have board members and everybody else, and teachers have kids here as well. We all have kids here that we worry about their progress. And we've seen some things over the last couple of years, and just from the discussions with the charts up there and everything, you can tell that it's a work in progress and that we're all here hoping that work in progress will help our kids. Because we've had two kids go through the system already, and our third kid is a six-year-old who's now going through a different curriculum and a different set of objectives that they're implementing now. And it's hard for us as parents sometimes to teach those kids when one set of kids has been taught
one way, and the next kid is slightly different. And now the third kid, so for us it's unique in that we've got three kids going through. That third kid is, it's an adjustment for us as parents as well. So we appreciate you guys helping us with that and explaining it to us at these meetings, but you know, we just want to make sure that the goal's not lost, that the first priority is not about monetary gain or, bringing in technology or what type of technology we're using. Bottom line is we want our kids to learn the way we learned, the way our other kids learned, and that our future generations learn the same way. So whatever technology, I work in IT, that we implement to do that, if it works, great. If it doesn't work, we need to scrap it quickly because we don't want it to continue to be more about learning how to use iPads or learning how to use smartphones. We want them to learn, and that's bottom line. The goal is for them to learn so that they can be independent thinkers and to be able to reflect themselves as they grow up and get out there in society and get a job, whether it's corporate America or anywhere else. We just want them to succeed, and I think success is the most important part for all of us here tonight. Sticking around till 9 o'clock, that was my focus today.
Thank you.
Thank you. We obviously the school is constantly evaluating the best practices and the student outcome. So appreciate your comments.
Thank you very much.
Next up, Craig Young.
Thank you, President Cooper, and thank you to the board for giving me this opportunity to make this very important statement on behalf of everyone, the teachers of District 58, the DGEA. We are here to thank our principals. Just like us and all the stakeholders of the district, we just heard from one, they want the district to move forward and to improve. And sometimes in order to accomplish this, we have to have difficult discussions. Together, we will always ensure the students succeed, and we want to say thank you to the principals for leading the way. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, that's it for cards. Is there anybody else who would like to comment, speak? Andy?
Andy Schmidt, DGEA Vice President. The agenda item I just wanted to bring up, maybe for some clarity's sake, is the policy 1150. I believe is up for approval tonight after some revisions to it at the previous board meeting. And the part that maybe some clarity to, and if you need to, maybe take a second stab at it. And this would relate to all communications being listed on the agenda. And President Cooper, you had referred to there being, I think, 18 communications listed on the agenda this evening. There was a 19th that I'm aware of that the governing board of the DGEA and also the executive board, in total about 40 teachers, unanimously directed a letter be sent to a board member, and that letter wasn't listed on the agenda. So I was a little confused. Maybe the timing was bad. So I took a look, and there was a previous communication in a prior meeting that was sent the day of the board meeting. It was sent at, I think it was 7:37 in the morning, and the DGEA email was sent at 7:33, so actually 4 minutes before the previous one. So it could have been the day of rationale that, it didn't get any time. So then I started looking at 1150 to see, well, gosh, why wouldn't a letter from the teachers to a board member be listed? And, maybe it had to do with it was the teachers. But again, previous email was from another employee group, and I dug a little deeper, took a look at, about the last 3.5 years of board meetings, and there were actually 26 months of agendas where there were emails, communications different from FOIA requests, but email communications to the board from either employees employee groups. That would be the custodian union, the ESP union, the teachers union, or members of those unions on their behalf. There was also numerous communications, about 50 in total, 50 communications. Also, non-residents of Downers Grove. So I was trying to see, well, maybe it was because...
Are you saying there were emails previously on correct. The agenda?
Correct.
I don't think we really need you to speculate. You know, obviously a mistake was made, so...
Okay. From my point of view, so again, when we report back to the governing board and the executive board as to why the communication wasn't listed on the agenda, you know, usually what we try to do, we don't speculate, we lay everything out. So that's why I'm trying to go through this. So getting back to...
Right, but it's speculation, and I don't know why the email was left off.
Thank you. I think maybe some clarity or defining language, if it's the intent to exclude communications.
Again, it's speculation, Andy. You don't know what the intent was.
Well, again, I'm asking for the clarity.
I can't give it to you at this particular time, but we'll have someone follow up.
So if, again, anything needs to be tweaked or adjusted to 1150, maybe take a look at it. Because all it says is citizens, and I think... Everybody's a citizen. So thank you for your time, and again,
could just be human error.
Yeah.
Well, there was also an opportunity to add any additional things to the agenda, and the board member didn't offer up that communication when you asked. So I guess it was oversight there. Thank you.
Thanks.
If there's no other people who wish to speak, we're going to take a short recess. It's 9:07. We will come back at 9:20.